So Sam Cooke, he's best known as an early rock and roll, rhythm and blues, soul hit machine. He had 29 top 40 singles from 1956 to his death in 1964. Back then, he was right up at the pinnacle of the musical world. This is how you might know him, through songs like this one. His career spanned the infancy and maturity of the civil rights movement, and his music displays three great civil rights themes, indeed three great themes of America, three great themes of the Christian faith in our country: faith in God, hope, and justice. And I'll share with you some of his music and some of my thoughts about him and about these three themes. First of all, his faith. For him, it was a family affair. He was born in Mississippi in 1931. When he was 2 years old, his family moved to Chicago, and his father was a pastor in the Church of Christ Holiness, which is a Baptist offshoot. Cooke sang gospel from a very, very early age, sang with the church choir, was given solos as early as when he was 5 or 6 years old. And as he grew older, people started to notice him, and his fame locally around Chicago among Baptists and other church groups started to increase. And when he was 16 years old, he was asked to become the lead singer for one of the great gospel groups of the era called the Soul Stirrers, one of the most famous groups in the entire country. That was in 1950, and he not only became the lead singer of the group at such an early age, but he also became a songwriter. He had this incredible talent for turning gospel stories into music, for, as he put it, preaching the word of God through the voice of his song. And so this is a song that he wrote, "Jesus Gave Me Water," based on the reading that we just heard.
Jesus gave me water. And it was not
in the
well. Well, there was a woman from Samaria came to the well to get some water. There she met a stranger who did a story tell. That a woman dropped a pitcher, she's reckoned was made richer from the water he gave her. And it was not in the well. Jesus gave her water. Jesus gave her water. Jesus gave her water. I wanna let it baby swell. Jesus gave her water. He gave that woman water. Gave a living love and lasting water. And it was not in the well.
Well, on that woman he had pity. She ran back to the city.
He wrote hundreds of songs based on the gospel, and the Soul Stirrers played in hundreds upon hundreds of venues throughout the country. Churches, black churches, I should specify, black venues that catered to gospel singers. They even broke out in their recording and in the selling of their albums into the white audience, one of the very, very few gospel groups that early to do so. And a lot of it was because of Sam Cooke, his energy that he brought to his music, the incredible attraction that he had to so many different people. If you remember that famous scene of when the Beatles first came to New York, all the people, especially the girls, just screaming their heads off at the four young lads from England. Sam Cooke had that same effect on people when he sang. It was something that carried over from the African-American spiritual tradition into his music and his concerts, and continued with him all through the rest of his career. One of the most extraordinary things about him in his songwriting was his ability to write a song quickly. And he developed a technique, mostly because he had a lot of fun doing it. You know, they traveled by car around that then from venue to venue, and he would sit in the back of the car, and he'd pull out his Bible, open it up, and point to a passage, and then he'd write a song about it. This is one of his most famous and one of the Soul Stirrer's biggest hits that came from that practice, Touch the Hem of His Garment, from the gospel passage in Luke where Cook, of course now my phone decides to update, there we go, the woman comes to Jesus in the crowd when Jesus is on his way to heal the little girl and touches the hem of his garment. Jesus notices her behind him and she is healed. This is Sam Cooke's interpretation of that.
Well, there was a woman in the Bible days. She had been sick so very long. Well, she heard my Jesus was passing by, so she joined the gathering throng. And while she was pushing her way through, someone asked her, "What are you trying to do?" She said, "If I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I'll be made whole." She cried, "Oh, and oh,
heard from the first song that I played, one of his great hits, You Send Me. He switched eventually in the very early 1960s from gospel to pop. And at the time, this was interpreted by many as him abandoning his faith, much like others like Aretha Franklin, for example, would do a little bit later. But Cooke explained in interviews that it wasn't any such thing at all. He remained an extremely faithful Christian. He still went to church. He still prayed. He still had a deep, deep faith in God and what God can do. He told one interviewer, he said, "My father told me it was not what I sang that wasn't important, but that God gave me a voice and musical talent, and the true use of his gift was to share it and to make people happy." And that became, that last little bit became one of the great themes of his life from now on. His goal and his deep desire, his passion, was to make people happy through his music. But he retained his faith all of his life, as we'll revisit at the very end of the sermon, and as Cooke revisited at the very end of his life. But just to give you an example, he suffered his own share of tragedies in his life. His infant son died by drowning in a pool, and his faith carried him and his wife, their faith together, carried them through that and into help them process their grief and to restore their lives together. But Sam Cooke's faith was always with him throughout his entire life. The second theme I want to talk about is justice, which became, of course, one of the hallmarks, one of the core values of the civil rights movement, and again, by extension, especially on this day and this week, one of the great hallmarks and one of the great dreams and hopes of American life. Cooke lived through and was deeply influenced by the struggles of blacks in segregated America. He didn't quite see it so much as the Soul Stirrers, with the Soul Stirrers, because there was a whole network of black churches and congregants who played host to the groups and cook food for them and help them along their way from one stop on the tour to another. But once he switched into pop music, it became glaring to him how problematic and how devastating segregation was to blacks throughout the country. He had to deal with all of the common stereotypical things that we know about, not being able to eat in certain places, being denied housing and lodging in hotels, the different water fountains and different bathrooms. He had to deal with all of those like everybody else. But there were other things that he especially had to deal with. For example, very early on, right after Yosemite came out, he was booked to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he was supposed to be the final act that particular night, but a previous act had run a little bit late, and so they cut Sam Cooke from the show. Well, he was outraged, and his manager was outraged. And, you know, they told Ed Sullivan how he missed this opportunity to have a black man on people's televisions throughout America, the many, many people who watched and loved the Ed Sullivan Show. To his credit, Ed Sullivan said, all right, I'm rearranging the next show, and you're first. So he gave Sam Cooke the highlight, the star billing on his next show. Back then, Sam Cooke played to segregated audiences. He was a pop star now, and so promoters wanted as many people to come to his shows as possible, and he'd play arenas and venues across the country, and places in Utica, you know, like the Stanley, for example, or Proctor's in Albany. A little bit later on, playing even bigger venues like baseball stadiums. And Sam Cooke was just distressed, just perplexed with how to deal with the segregated audiences. Usually it would be either the blacks on one side and the whites on the other, or the whites in the main area and then the blacks in a balcony far away from the stage. And so I think it was in Atlanta. it was in Atlanta or in Athens, Georgia. It was in Georgia. And Sam Cooke finally said, enough is enough. He said, I'm not playing tonight. I'm not playing any more segregated audiences. I refuse. And he went on stage. He didn't tell the promoters or the officials. They're always town and city and county officials, armed guards and sheriffs there to try to keep any conflicts down among the crowd. But he didn't tell anybody. So he came up on stage, and my name is Sam Cooke. People went nuts. I'm not playing tonight to a segregated audience. I'll only play to an integrated audience. And the crowd just went wild, and the officials knew that they had big trouble on their hands, not for the reasons they expected, but because Sam Cooke himself was standing up for the injustices. So finally they decided, all right, we'll let people sit where they want. And Cooke was one of the first Americans to play to integrated audiences in our country. There were other problems and outright dangers that he faced. One of the really, really big issues that black performers had to face was what happened on the road. You might know Gretchen Soren's wonderful book, Driving While Black. Well, she explains this in her book, but it happened personally to Cooke. In the South especially, white vigilantes would be on the lookout for blacks driving. And they knew black musicians were on a very tight schedule. They finished the gig at 10 o'clock, 11 at night, had to pack up, and then had to get to the next place where they were playing, sometimes 200-300 miles away. And so people got a pretty good handle on where they were going and what roads they were taking. Cooke was involved in a car crash that was caused by a group of white drivers trying to run him off the road. One of his good friends was actually killed in an incident in Alabama. But Cooke persevered. Eventually, for his own benefit and safety, he started to, and because he was becoming so famous that he had the money, he started to fly from venue to venue, and even sometimes having armed escorts. He always worked for justice as well. He, through his own experience, he knew to the marrow of his bones how difficult it was for blacks to make it in the music business in white America. So he decided that he was going to try to sidestep that. And so he created his own company. his own recording company, his own promotion company, his own payment and royalties company called SAR Records. And he especially wanted to sign young black performers who were just starting out, so they didn't have to go through the same things that he did to try to alleviate their own suffering and to try to help them move on. And his passion for justice eventually showed up into his music, but in very, very subtle ways. He always said that he wanted to play for both a white and a black audience. Again, it was that whole idea of bringing happiness to as many people as possible. And also, he was very practical and a very smart businessman. He knew that the money, increasingly in the early 60s, for recording artists, came out of the pockets of white parents whose teenagers insisted that they buy them these records, or teenagers themselves if they had a little job mowing lawns or something like that. But it came through in his music. And one of his songs, one of his number one hits, came from something that he saw on the side of the road while driving through the South. And he always had a, he wanted to do it right. You know, he didn't want to so much preach or, you know, be so assertive and in your face about how he wanted racial relations to change. But what he wanted to do was to expose people's experiences. He wanted to show the humanity of people. And so we did that in this song, which is called Chain Gang.
I hear something saying, sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down, working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away. Then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Can't you hear them saying, I'm going home one of these days. I'm going home, see my woman whom I love so.
He always wanted to show rather than tell, so he didn't say explicitly that the chain gang system was a continuation of the American system of black slavery, with blacks now being arrested and thrown into jail for minor offenses and then being put to work on the roads. But instead, he showed the humanity of the people doing that work in his music. And it was a theme that he used over and over and over again in his songs. Finally, there's hope. And hope was always part of what Sam Cooke wanted to express. He had great hope in humanity. He had great hope that through their own strength and perseverance and talent, that black musicians would achieve greatness and reach the same levels of success and cultural influence as white singers. He had great hope that whites would recognize the brilliance and beauty of black music in America, and he had hope that the races would indeed come together and would heal the divisions in America. It would take a long time after he died in 1964, and still, of course, there is a lot of work to do. But Cook was one of those ones who has been an inspiration to all of those that followed him. Now, hope was a theme in all of his music. Again, back to You Send Me, he loved to write love songs, and those were the ones that really struck a chord with the teenagers who were buying his, or the parents whose teenagers made the parents buy the music with their money. This was one of his greatest hits, and one of the really one of the most hopeful and beautiful songs ever written, I think.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the facts I do, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about geography, don't know much trigonometry, don't know much about algebra, don't know what a sliding room is for. But I do know what it was too. And if this world could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be.
Cook sang for all people, and at the same time, he very clearly recognized that race relations in the United States in 1962, 1963 were fracturing and becoming worse than ever. He saw what was going on. He saw the lynchings. He saw the protests. He saw the violence. He heard the rhetoric. He was very clear-headed about what was happening. And I think this is the same in general with American Christianity. We proclaim hope, we proclaim peace, we proclaim love, we share the Last Supper and you know, hope that that spiritually feeds us. But at the same time, I think Christians at the core understand the reality of the pain, suffering, and evil that's out there in the world. So Cook, in that sense, was a great emblem of what it means to be an American Christian. Now, with his focus on justice and with his hope, a question that comes up retrospectively is, did he also become dangerous? He was criticized from every angle in his own days, especially in 1962, 1963, moving into 1964. Whites criticized him for trying to break that color barrier and trying to bring the music that many whites called black music for black people into the white realm, supposedly taking over space that should be for white artists, a very common theme that you still hear in culture and in society these days. Many blacks, especially more radical ones, criticized him for trying to be too white, for going playing in front of white audiences. So Cook was really getting it from both sides. And yet his popularity continued to explode with hit after hit, again, 29 of them. But then on the night of December 11th, 1964, under a strange and baffling and still to this day somewhat conspiratorial circumstances, Cook was murdered in a Los Angeles hotel room. Nobody knows who did it. Nobody quite understands the details and the circumstances of the murder. But Sam Cooke died on that night in late 1964. What's extraordinary, though, is how after his death, he became even more popular, he became even more significant, and how he became even more an emblem of the civil rights movement and of American freedom. First of all, his body was flown from L.A. to Chicago, where he grew up, and over the next several days, 200,000 people showed up for his funeral. All of them, not just to see the casket, not just to walk through, but showed up at the church for his funeral in the surrounding neighborhoods. It was just like a long days-on-end service with just rotating people coming and going. And he had done something right before his death that became extraordinary and perhaps wouldn't have been extraordinary had he not died in the way he did. And that was his final song. He started writing it about a year before he died in late 1963, early 1964. And as he explained when the song was finally released in the fall of 1964, for the first time in his life, he said, he felt that the Holy Spirit was giving him music and lyrics to write. You know, he said, yeah, I'd done all that stuff with pulling verses from the Bible and, you know, repeating the Bible message with the soul stirs and all that. But this was something that didn't come from up here. This is something that came from elsewhere. And he said that he thought it was a message that America needed to hear. It wasn't something so much personal as it was through his person, God speaking to the country. And since then, since its release in the fall of 1964, especially since Cook's death, this song, A Change Is Gonna Come, has become one of the great anthems of the civil rights movement and of the hope for racial justice in America. A song filled with faith, with justice, and with hope. A song that Sam Cooke gave as his final gift, and a song that can be in the hearts of all of us Americans in this time when we remember and think about our country and where we've been and where we hope to be. Amen.